I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tenzina Vega. You're listening to The Takeaway. On May 31st, 1921, a violent white mob in Tulsa, Oklahoma, enacted a deadly and destructive massacre that nearly destroyed the thriving black community of Greenwood.
On May 31st, 21, I went to bed in my family's home in Greenwood, neighbors of Tulsa, the neighborhood I felt asleep in that night, was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me.
That's 107-year-old Viola Fletcher, one of the few living survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, testifying before Congress on May 19th in an effort to secure reparations for survivors and descendants of the massacre. According to the 2001 Race Riot Commission report, white mobs killed as many as 300 people and destroyed more than 1,200 homes and businesses.
The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seen being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day.
Mrs. Fletcher testified alongside two other survivors, her 100-year-old brother, Hughes Van Ellis, and 106-year-old Leslie Benningfield Randall.
We were told they just dumped the dead bodies into the river. I remember running outside of our house. I just passed dead bodies. It wasn't a pretty sight. I still see it today in my mind, 100 years later.
Van Ellis, a World War II veteran, told lawmakers that survivors of the Tulsa race massacre never received any compensation for what was taken from them, and that their efforts in the court system so far have been dismissed.
We were made to feel that our struggle was unworthy of justice, that we were less valued than whites, that we weren't fully Americans. We were shown that in the United States, not all men were equal under law. We were shown that when black voices called out for justice, no one cared.
For more on the history and legacy of the Tulsa race massacre 100 years later, we're joined by Professor Carlos K. Hill, the Regents Professor and Chair of the African and African American Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and author of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. Carlos, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
I want to start in Greenwood before the massacre. Tell me about this thriving community where this little 7-year-old girl goes to bed feeling safe.
Circa 1921, Tulsa's Greenwood District was one of the most affluent black communities in the country. And part of the reason the Greenwood District is known today is because of Booker T. Washington in 1913, referring to the Greenwood District as the Negro Wall Street of America. And what Booker T. Washington was attempting to do was to tilt black Americans' eyes toward Tulsa, toward Greenwood, and help them to understand that the affluence that black people had accumulated in the Greenwood District, that was possible for them as well. And so Booker T. Washington wanted African Americans to understand Greenwood as a kind of shining symbol of what was possible in Jim Crow America. If it could happen in Tulsa, black Americans could possibly have a different reality in Jim Crow America. And so when the mob attacked Greenwood and destroyed its homes and businesses, it wasn't just those homes and businesses that were attempting to be destroyed. It was the idea that Black people could prosper in these United States, particularly in the segregated United States that was America in 1921. And so that also was under attack, under threat. But luckily, fortunately, for us, the community rebuilt. That idea was revived. And today it still lives on. In the words of Mother Randall, in the words of Mother Fletcher, as well as Hugh Van Ellis.
That point that that Washington had turned the eyes of Black America to Tulsa, that this was standing as this shining beacon, then the destruction, the massacre there in Greenwood becomes a kind of collective lynching, right? Because lynching is never just about violence against the one body. It is always also an act of terrorism. So what I heard you say was that this also was meant to terrorize, to blot out the notion of this kind of Black success for Black folks throughout the country.
Absolutely. Lynching revolves around terrorism. Terrorism as a form of social control. And with lynching, it's a form of racial social control. I have often referred to what occurred on May 31st and June 1st at minimum as a massacre, but it could be framed as a community lynching. With lynching, the history of lynching, a classic lynching really typically involves an individual or their family is the target. With Greenwood, the target of the violence was the community. The goal was not just to destroy, but also to expel Black people, those 11,000 residents who had built Greenwood in approximately 15 years into the Negro Wall Street of America or Black Wall Street. The goal was to expel them from the community. And in writing a photographic history of the race massacre, I came across numerous photographs that helped me to tell that story. One photograph in particular was transformed into a postcard. And the caption on that postcard read, "Running the Negro out of Tulsa." That photograph captured for me what was in the hearts and the minds of whites as they burned, as they looted, as they destroyed this historic community. It certainly was a massacre, but I think you could also make a compelling argument that it was a community lynching and an attempted expulsion of Tulsa's Black residents.
Professor Hill, tell us more about the photographs that you found and the story they tell.
One of the things that I discovered in beginning my research, deep research on the race massacre, was not only is it the deadliest attack, single attack on a Black community in American history, it may be the most photographed instance of anti-Black violence in American history. And beginning to talk to the community members about this history and talking to them in ways about this history that they revealed to me that this was in fact a massacre, trying to piece together, this history and how to, compellingly offer it up to people who have no idea about the scale and the scope of it. I discovered these photographs and I couldn't look away. I just could not believe what I was seeing in these photographs, a 35 block area completely destroyed in less than 24 hours. And so it became incumbent upon me to try to figure out a way to leverage those photographs to tell a story, not the story that the white mob wanted to tell in documenting it and creating these photographs, but in fact, the story that Viola Fletcher told in Congress, Hugh Van Ellis told in Congress just last week, Mother Randall told the story of how this community was viciously attacked and in less than 24 hours destroyed. I think the photographs bring that home in ways that even words can't. And so it became my mission to figure out a way to use documents, photographs that were created by the mob, but that, 100 years later could potentially, if paired alongside of oral history accounts from survivors, could tell a different story, could be recontextualized to help people understand just the scale and scope of what occurred. And so the photographic history contains about 175 photographs, about 130, 140 of them, or, you know, depict the massacre, and another 30 or 40 of them depict or help us to understand who survivors were, help us to understand their stories. And so I wrote that book in a moment where, or began to write that book in a moment where the Watchmen was not a part of our conversation. Lovecraft Country wasn't a part of our conversation. Imagining a world where you had to convince people that this was a massacre. And so those photographs became Exhibit A in the argument for why, at minimum, we have to talk about this as a massacre. And I hope, to the extent that the photographs and the oral histories bring that to the fore, I hope that that was accomplished.
Your point that it was the mob itself that were taking these photographs, that they had transformed them into postcards and were proud of these actions, goes to the very heart of what is also talked about in the 2001 commission report, now 20 years old, that says not one of these criminal acts was then or ever has been prosecuted or punished by government at any level, and that no government at any level offered any resistance at the time that it was happening. Is there any possibility now that any measure of justice is possible for survivors and descendants?
Absolutely. There's a lot of room for justice and accountability. Although white men and boys and women who perpetrated this atrocity on the community or have long died, the city of Tulsa is still here. The state of Oklahoma is still here. Those entities aided and abetted and were complicit in the violence. And I'll give you just two examples. Rather than disarm whites who began to shoot and attempt to kill black men who had come downtown to protect Dick Rowland, what did local authorities do? They weaponized the mob. They gave them orders to kill and detain black men who they believe were in rebellion. That was number one. Number two, rather than prevent whites from invading the community, the local authorities invaded the community with them. Rather than support the community in the aftermath and rebuilding, the city attempts to impede and actually prevent the community from rebuilding. Again, rather than provide restitution and reparations for victims, for survivors, for descendants of this history, the city initially said that it would, and then days later reneged. And so if the race massacre is not just the deadliest attack on a black community in American history, it also represents the liquidation of intergenerational black wealth. And so today there can be a historic investment into the community, an investment that has never happened, but should have.
So bring me to Tulsa today, to those blocks, to historic Greenwood. What is life there right now?
It's certainly not the Black Wall Street of 1921. But I would argue that the Greenwood District, Black Wall Street, remains a symbol of Black excellence. What we have to remember is what made Greenwood special is not the buildings, not the businesses. It's the people. And the people are as tenacious, as gritty, as resourceful as black people were in 1921 and today in Tulsa in 2021. But what we've had with the community is a series of efforts, attempts by the city to harm this community, beginning in the 1960s and 70s with urban removal. The Greenwood District over time has been gutted, and today there are very few black-owned businesses and even black landholders in the Greenwood mm-hmm. District. And so when community members talk about the urban removal policies of the 1960s and 70s, that is what they're referring to. And in many cases, completed the work that the mm-hmm. white mob began in 1921. And so Greenwood of today is not the Greenwood of 1921, but the bones are still good. The people are still pretty as resourceful. Black Wall Street, despite the fact that it's not the same as it was in 1921, still is a symbol of Black excellence, that symbol that Booker T. Washington, more than 100 years ago, spoke of.
And I have to say, like, the post-Katrina New Orleanian in me jumps up with joy and recognition at the idea that community is about much more than just the buildings. It is always about the people and the spirit of community that exists in that space. And there is still room for justice in Tulsa. Carlos K. Hill is Regents Professor and Chair of the African and African-American Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma and author of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, a photographic history. Professor Hill, thank you for joining us.
And Melissa, thank you for having me.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.